English translation. Anyone who chants this narration, or even thinks of this narration about the activities of Maharaj Ambarish, certainly becomes a pure devotee of the Lord. Of course, this is the last two sets of verses in this particular chapter, which summarises Ambarish Maharaj's Leela, particularly that notably with the Devasa Muni, which we'll get into later, but let's read the Prabhupada's purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur herein gives a very good example. When one is very eager for more and more money, he's not satisfied even when he's a millionaire or a multimillionaire, but he wants to earn more and more money by any means. The same mentality is present in a devotee. The devotee is never satisfied, thinking, this is the limit of my devotional service. The more he engages in the service of the Lord, the more service he wants to give. This is the position of a devotee. Maharaj Ambarish, in his family life, was certainly a pure devotee, complete in every respect, because his mind and all his senses were engaged in devotional service. Savai mana krishna pada randvin nayo vachamsi vaikuntha guna noon vanane. Maharaj Ambarish was very satisfied because all of his senses were engaged in devotional service. Savopadni vini muktam tad paravtmena nimalam hrishikena hrishikesha sevanam bhakte uchate. Nevertheless, although Ambarish Maharaj had engaged all his senses in devotional service, he left his home and went to the forest to concentrate his mind fully at the lotus feet of Krishna, exactly as a mercantile man, although, even though complete in wealth, tries to earn more and more. This mentality of getting more and more and engaged in devotional service puts one in the most exalted position. Whereas, on the karma platform, the mercantile man who wants more and more money becomes increasingly bound and entangled and becomes increasingly... And the devotee becomes increasingly liberated. Glad I got that bit right. Amagyanam tididam dasya jalangala shalakaya taksho maritam yena tasmai shri gurve namaha shri titanya manobistam sapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa dharamayam tabati svapatantikam he krishna kuruna sindhu dina bandhu jagapate gopisha gopikanta radha kanta namushtate nama om vishnu padaya krishna saya bhutale shimati bhaktivedanta swamiti namine namaste sasvati devi kuravani pracharine nevasesha shunyavadi prashachades tarine shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda siadvaita gadadha sivasadi gurvaktivinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. There's the following verse as well, which I'll read as well. Ambarishyasya taritam ye shrinvanti mahatmanaha muktim payanti tatva sarve bhaktya vishnu prasadataha. By the grace of the Lord, those who hear about the activities of Maharaj Ambarish, the great devotee, certainly becomes liberated or becomes a devotee without delay. I wanted to get more into the purport slightly later on. However, in summary, what Prabhupada is saying here, he's striking a comparison, I think, between devotees, great devotees such as Maharaj Ambarish, and of course the materialists, because both are hankering after something. Both will not give up. Both categories are not satisfied, or they just want that bit more. So similarly, of course, great devotees, or even any devotee really, just wants that little bit more devotional service, and of course that's a good thing. However, on the other side of the same coin, as it were, those who are, even if they're materially successful, millionaires or multi-millionaires, are never quite satisfied and want that little bit more. However, the results of these two seemingly similar, but very, the results of these activities are very different from each other. One, which of course is pursuing the material line, always ends up enshrouded in fear and anxiety. Whereas the other one becomes, eventually works one's way to become a pure devotee. And indeed, the verses here itself say that just by hearing about the activities of and Barish Maharaj, one can achieve liberation. So it gives you an idea of the potency that the leelas within the Bhagavatam possess. Of course, I assume that one has to really, really focus on it, and not like me, but that's the kind of the benefits here are spelled out here in these two final verses. Of course, I imagine, because you've been doing chapters 4 and 5 recently, I imagine you've heard much about Ambarish anyway in the last few months. But just in summary, Maharaj Ambarish, of course, I think he was living around the Treta Yuga time because he was offering many elaborate sacrifices. He was essentially the emperor of the entire world and was wealthy beyond our comprehension by today's standards, wealthy beyond belief. So much facility, gold, servants and so forth were at his disposal. But actually he lived a very, very simple thing. And all he cared about, of course, was the Lord and his citizens. And this opulence that he was surrounded by didn't go to his head, so to speak. He was the perfect king in many respects. And, of course, this is why Prabhupada, actually, in his purport, makes this comparison. One may be a millionaire or multimillionaire. But if his only aim is to get more and more and more, then he's essentially lost the plot. But here's Ambarish, who was by today's standards a multi-billion billionaire, being the emperor of the entire world. And yet he was very, very simple. And indeed, at the end of his life, he simply passed his wealth and his inheritance onto his sons. And he went to live in the forest to meditate, of course, on the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And this is the idea that if someone is a Maharaja or a great king, often it means one has inherited it, which is a different from one who has worked very hard from poverty to become a millionaire. The Vedic kings were born into these families. However, which sounds one that was just good luck, but actually, of course, nothing happens by chance. In those times, one was born into a great Kshatriya royal family because of what they essentially deserved from previous lives. However, there was a great responsibility that went with it as well, i.e. the more material facility one has, the more pressure it is to use it in the right way, because the more cost there is if it's used in the wrong way. There's more at stake. So therefore, great material opulence is like a razor's edge, as it were. And particularly today, in the Kali Yuga, it's 99% or something like that of extremely wealthy people are going to become distracted due to the age of Kali, distracted by their opulence, and it's going to be very detrimental to their spiritual life. Of course, that we can't say that it applies to every single wealthy person in the Kali Yuga, but by and large, because of the influence of the age of Kali and the lack of God consciousness, we can see that it becomes very intoxicating for them. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But just as a reminder, the Maharaj Ambarish, of course, he was an Atman in Vedanam. He was engaging all his senses. He had no other motive as an Atma other than to serve the Supreme Lord. Of course, the Leela with Dhruva Maharaj, Dvasa Muni, forgive me. He was, although he was spiritually very, very powerful personality, mystically very powerful, he also had a very bad temper, and he appears in a number of leelas, of course, like in the Mahabharata as well. Dvasa Muni was, if you didn't follow etiquette, if you didn't put him at the centre, he would get very angry and probably curse you. So therefore, by force, perhaps, he received a lot of respect whenever he went. Of course, Maharaj Ambarish wasn't motivated by fear of Dvasa Muni, but so when Dvasa Muni and his disciples came to the emperor's palace, he received them very nicely. But of course, as you already know, it was during a time of fasting for Ambarish Maharaj. And when he broke that fast, according to the standard, with just a little bit of water, because Dvasa Muni hadn't been fed himself by then, Dvasa Muni, of course, was bathing in the river. Dvasa Muni was offended by this, although it was a very, very, very minor, if not offence, in fact not an offence at all, because Ambarish himself was simply following the Vedic injunction and the Brahminical code. He was the day after Ekadashi, he just had a little bit of water, that was it. However, it seems that Dvasa Muni appeared to be I was talking how people can get overwhelmed or intoxicated by their wealth. It would appear here that Dvasa Muni was intoxicated by his mystic power. So Was he that spiritual, in a sense? Powerful, yes. But actually, this chapter is actually explaining that although Maharaj Ambarish was in a lower varna than Devasamuni, i.e. a Kshatriya rather than a Brahmin, Ambarish was actually more spiritually advanced and had the blessings of the Lord. And that's actually an ongoing theme, I think, with this leela. Of course, when Devasamuni, I think he manifested this great fiery demon to kill Maharaj Ambarish, completely over-the-top reaction, so intoxicated. At that point, because Maharaj Ambarish was so dear to the Lord, of course, the Sudarshan Chakra came. It also comes to destroy all powerful people, even on the subterranean realms, that chakra comes to kill those, end people's lives of those intoxicated by the material opulence. Chases Devasamuni right across the universe. And of course, in the end, Devasamuni has to fall at the feet of Maharaj Ambarish and beg for forgiveness just to spare his life. Of course, Ambarish was very happy, of course, to do this. Being humble, he then himself did prayers to the Sudarshan Chakra and glorificating the Lord, glorifying the Lord. Because Ambarish forgave him, everything else was settled. And of course, that is very important, because the lesson here is that Lord Narayan could not excuse a person who had offended a Vaishnava. Devasamuni had offended Ambarish. To be excused from such an offence, one should submit to the Vaishnava whom he has offended. So the standard would be, if one has offended a great Vaishnava, you have to go to the person who you've offended and beg for that forgiveness. There's no other way to be excused from the anger of the Lord, actually, in that sense. However, in the end, Devasamuni saw sense and everything was sorted out. But I just wanted to share some of the mood of Ambarish Maharaj as he was serving the Lord with that great eagerness, with that passion, with that mood to always have that little bit more. As described in the preface to the Nectar of Devotion, every service has some attractive feature which drives the servitor progressively on and on. Every one of us within this world is perpetually engaged in some sort of service. And the impetus for such service is the pleasure we derive from it. Driven by affection for his wife and children, a family man works day and night. A philanthropist works in the same way for the love of the greater family, and a nationalist works for the country. That force that drives these people is called a ras, a mellow, a relationship whose taste is very sweet. Bhakti ras is a mellow different from the ordinary ras enjoyed by mundane workers. Mundane workers labour very hard day and night in order to relish a certain kind of ras, which is ultimately sense gratification and the gain of wealth. The taste of the mundane ras does not long endure, and therefore mundane workers are always apt to change their position of enjoyment and ultimately never become happy. So that's actually from the Nectar of Devotion. I think that's very relevant for our verse here. But that goes back to what we were saying earlier, that there are many, many modern examples of people who work very, very hard, of course, to achieve name, fame, adoration, pride, profit, and distinction. We only have to turn to the music world or the pop, you know, the pop stars and or famous actors in Hollywood, or of course the business category, or of course the political platform as well, where these people generally have great material success. But ultimately, much to the pleasure of the tabloid press, there's always fall downs. There's always, it's a real razor's edge. As soon as they do a small thing wrong, or in sometimes a very big thing wrong, they get their karma instantly. And I won't go into individual names, but it does seem that despite what we may be told by the media, or what we may be even be told by many of the sources, the material success on material purposes alone does not bring the satisfaction that everyone was expecting. Otherwise, why would so many rock and pop stars and even politicians and so forth, or actors, turn to drugs, or they always end up falling down, or their own relationships seem to be very much more a struggle than those who are less materially opulent? Is this not evidence in itself that this is not the route to happiness alone? Of course, if one is Krishna consciousness, and goes into politics or whatever it might be, then great. But here the example is that we understand that in the Kali Yuga, most people with material success tend not to be Krishna conscious, because the society that we're living in is all policies are driven by economic considerations. It seems that the gold or money seems to be the only motive that seems to be affecting politicians, or by and large, what is the rate, what is the interest rate, what is this, what is that. But there's very little talk about moral or spiritual principles as government policy, for example. We only hear about this amount of tax, this amount of tax, this amount of money, etc. But never any policies that promoted forward to the population that we will actually help you spiritually. It is not on the agenda. Of course, going back to the time of Maharaj Ambarish and indeed Kshatriya regimes before the Kali Yuga, look at Yudhisthira, for example. His whole point was, that, and that of Maharaj Prichit as well, their whole agenda was, we live in times of plenty, but we should always offer our respects to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, for he is our ultimate benefactor, and the role of the emperor or the king was to represent the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was the earthly representative. Of course, nowadays, as I mentioned before, people are so much driven by fear, given ambitions, given encouraged to have aims which are either unattainable, or even if you attain them, then you don't receive the happiness that you were expecting to have. And often this is driven by a fear, propagated often by the media or television, where people have to become rich one way or the other. So in the purport, it talks about people striving to become millionaires or multimillionaires. But often, how do you do that? There's only so many amount of people that can become wealthy. It's like a pyramid effect. Because if everyone was a millionaire, then the prices will go up a million times. So therefore, everyone will become poor. So you can only have a minority of people that are at the top of the pyramid. So many people who strive for wealth, name, fame, and adoration are going to be disappointed by definition. Not everyone can be famous, or not everyone can be ultimately rich, because that's relative. However, the idea that the... often people become rich by any means, and they don't care in the Kali Yuga how they become rich, selling people things they don't need. For example, there's so many things that you don't need. That most adverts you see in the television or on newspapers are just lies, nothing more than lies or exaggerations. Ultimately, it's just trying to make someone else rich. You don't need most of the products that are advertised. You need certain things, obviously. Don't go over the top. Not that we all have to live under a tree or something like that. Or if you want to, fine. If that's how you are, great. But there's so many unnecessary things, and ultimately the only purpose of them is to make someone rich. I'll give you a good example. In America, there was a doctor that was prosecuted, taken to court, and defeated in court for offering his patient a lemon to cure a cold. Why? Because he didn't offer them Lemsip, which was what the chemist was selling. What is Lemsip? It's lemon with sugar in it and a few other chemicals. So that's how far away from nature people can become. Where the economies of the different countries of the world and the corporations try to become more powerful than God, so to speak. A lemon is all you need to cure a cold, and a bit of ginger. Anyone can tell you that. However, no one makes much money out of that if too many people know the truth about the pharmaceutical industry, for example, where there's a lot of money that is just made out of nothing, just to make materialistic people more rich. It's not that every single thing is wrong, of course, but you'll be surprised how much corruption there is on a global scale that we're not told about. But anyway, if we look at, go back to Yudhisthira Maharaj, and how great he was as a devotee. But again, Prabhupada was making the comparison between people never always hankering for something, whether it's a devotee or materialist. Look at Yudhisthira Maharaj compared with Duryodhana, for example, in the Mahabharata. Duryodhana was extreme. He was the emperor of the world. He became the emperor by unfair means, but nevertheless, of course, having his Hastinapur, the city of many elephants, under his wing, he was extremely opulent beyond our comprehension. actually. So opulent, so wealthy, so much power. But was he satisfied? No, he was always striving for more. He couldn't even bear the idea of the Pandavas having even as much land to fit the tip of a needle. That's how envious he became. And how much, so although despite his position that he got, he was always full of fear. He could barely sleep at night, wondering, when are the Pandavas going to come out of the forest and get me? There was a price to pay for that, because he wasn't a devotee. He was quite demoniac. Although he was cultured in the eyes of some of his... no doubt he performed sacrifices and so forth, at least for show. But obviously, ultimately, he was only interested in his own gain. And ultimately, it was his responsibility that caused the largest war in known Vedic history. And that's the Battle of Kuru, etc. So, and yet, why was he not dissatisfied with that? Why could he not even give the Pandavas just a bit of land? He could not even do that because he was so intoxicated by his wealth. Because the more you have, the more you want. I'll just have that little bit more. I'll just get rid of the Pandavas. I'll just put the Pandavas over there in Indraprastha. That will sort them out. Oh no, they're becoming powerful. Right, send them to the forest. Oh no, they're still here. Kill them all! And he didn't need these things. You don't need a palace. You only need a certain amount of things. But yes, Kshatriyas in those times, including, of course, Yudhisthira, had these facilities. But they were for to facilitate the worship and the glorification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the welfare of the citizens. It reminds me, how much time? What time do we finish now? It's Kartik. Do we have to finish at 8:30 still? Or can we go over a bit? Or maybe, okay, I'll go to about 8:35 then, 10 minutes. Another example within Krishna's Leela, of course, is the story of Sudama Brahman. We all know that story. That's a great story where Sudama Brahman, of course, was a friend of Krishna when he was young. Of course, by the time that Krishna had moved to Dwarka and become again extremely, extremely opulent, it's okay, Krishna can be opulent, we don't mind that. But Sudama Brahman, of course, was again a pure devotee, and he lived in great poverty. His village had become very, very poor. He had wife and children. He could barely afford to feed them. So, as a responsible wife might expect to do, she turned to her husband and she said, "Look, you've got a good friend, not, you know, a few hundred miles away. His name's Krishna. Yeah, I'm sure he can lend you something, you know, a couple of bars of gold, maybe some fruit. You know, come on, you know, you've got the contacts. Why are you not using them?" And of course, Sudama Brahman's mood was never to take anything from Krishna, only to give worship to Krishna. But he understood, so he humbly thought, "Well, okay, I'll go and see my friend Krishna. I haven't seen him for a while. We've kind of gone our separate ways a little bit." So he got Krishna's favorite rice. He thought, "This is all I can afford. I can barely afford to feed my wife and children. But here's just this little bit of rice I've got. Let me just get this together, cook some Krishna's favorite rice, put it into a bungle, and I'll go to Dwarka." Of course, Krishna doesn't need that rice, just like Krishna doesn't need a fruit, a flower, a little bit of water, but he would accept it. So when Sudama Brahman, of course, got to Dwarka city, Krishna welcomed him, of course, with open arms as a great friend of his. He allowed him into his palace, they chatted, they hugged, they spoke, they sang together, they everything together. In fact, Sudama Brahman was so happy to see Krishna, he actually forgot he gave him the rice, of course. Krishna tasted the rice and, really nice, he really appreciated it. In fact, that he was completely, he didn't need to eat anything else that afternoon because he was satisfied with the rice that Sudama had offered him. However, Sudama was so happy to see Krishna, he forgot to say, "By the way, I'm living in poverty, can you lend me a few quid?" You know, he forgot that. And he started on his journey home. But of course, Krishna, being the Supreme Lord, knew exactly why he'd come and thought, "Here is someone who's not attached. Here is someone who is unmotivated. Here's my pure devotee." So I don't know exactly how he did it. He clicked his fingers, whatever happened. He did something. By the time that Sudama Brahman returned to his village, there was no longer that little hut there with his wife, kind of perhaps rather thin and emaciated in there. Rather, there was a great palace full of maid servants and gardens and everything like that. So Krishna rewards those who actually ultimately, even if not in this world, surely in the next. And a very good example, I think, of unmotivated devotional service is another Krishna Leela, which is when Krishna pretended to have a headache. Krishna doesn't actually have pain. Krishna didn't actually have one of our headaches where he needs to take some Lemsip or some paracetamol or something like that. But he was having this, as part of his leela, he was having a headache. He said, I need someone to cure my headache. I need the dust from someone's feet. And you rub it on my head, and that's what will cure my headache. So people were asking around, well, who's going to get the dust from their feet and put it on Krishna's head? And of course, the citizens of Dwarka were thinking, well, put my feet, the dust from my feet, on Krishna's head. I'll go to hell for doing that. I'm not qualified to put my feet on Krishna's head, even if symbolically that's what it would mean. I'm going to go to hell in my next life for doing that. No way I can't do that, just for a little headache. It wasn't, who was it who did it? It was only the gopis of Vrindavan. That to travel all the way from Dwarka city, his messenger, and go all the way to Vrindavan to find the gopis who were prepared to go to hell just to cure Krishna's headache. Again, pure, unalloyed devotional service without any other motive, where one who's even prepared to suffer themselves just for the pleasure of the Lord or to combat Krishna's suffering. Of course, it's not that, of course, Krishna's headache was cured by the dust of the lotus feet of the gopis, and of course the gopis didn't go to hell, but the point was, it was about motive. It's about motive. Again, one become a millionaire or multi-millionaire if one is a great devotee, fine. If one's motive is different, then perhaps there'll be challenges. You'll find yourself on a razor's edge of ego and material desires. I do want to kind of complete and to finish off actually by some nice examples from some of the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which really kind of summarise the mood of humility of this devotional service. This is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur has wrote. Slay me or protect me as you wish, for you are the master of your eternal servant. If it is your will that I be born again, then may it be in the home of your devotee. May I be born again even as a worm, so as long as I remain your devotee. I have no desire to be born as a Brahma or demigod, averse to you. These are the kind of the strengths of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings. He continues in the next song here. Considering myself lower than the blade of grass, bringing the quality of forbearance into my heart, showing respect to all, myself being freed from all false pride, when will I taste the essence of the liquid nectar of the holy name? Wealth, following beautiful women, as described in worldly poetry, I do not want any such bodily pleasures. O Lord, please give me unmotivated devotion to your lotus feet, birth after birth. So of course, this mood of Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also expressed differently, but also expressed by his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, who was very, very never satisfied with his preaching, even though he opened 84 centres or 82 centres of the Gaudiya Math around India. Was it 82? 64, I thought so, yeah. Anyway, as many, many centres around India of the Gaudiya Math. Still, on his deathbed, he was not satisfied. He said, my movement has not spread outside of India. I'm not satisfied. Who will continue this mission? And of course, on his deathbed, amongst other letters, he received one from Abhay Charanavindam Day, of course, who we all know is Srila Prabhupada, who said, whatever you want me to do, just tell me to do it. And he said, I want you to go to the Western world. I want you to take these teachings of Mahaprabhu outside of India and take it to the rest of the world. And of course, Prabhupada himself, of course, is a great example of someone who is full of unalloyed devotional service, who was doing a lot, never quite satisfied, wanted more and more centres, more disciples, more and more books distributed. And this again is the transcendental mood of not being satisfied. Not, of course, that when a devotee is satisfied by always wanting to do more, whereas on the material platform, doesn't matter what one has, one will never be satisfied. And that's the difference as described in the purport today. Hare Krishna. I think we'll stop there unless there's any points or anything anyone wants to add. Okay, one quick question.